WHBI, Hoyt Brothers Incorporated, Newark, New Jersey. Ladies and gentlemen, we present at this time the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan. Many friends of Father Coughlin are anxious to hear his reaction to the declaration of a war that may become a worldwide war. Today's address will not disappoint you. It's titled, The Good Samaritan, and its purpose is to plead with Americans to play the part of a good Samaritan. Copies of this address are available for all who care to write to Father Coughlin, who will continue to carry on his campaign to preserve neutrality as long as he will be permitted to do so by the government, and as long as your support will sustain him. Naturally, ladies and gentlemen, Social Justice Magazine will continue to sustain the government and any legislation passed by Congress. And naturally, the forthcoming issues will continue to militate against unchristian wars, for it is our contention that had the plans and policies of the late Pope Benedict XV been incorporated in the peace treaty of Versailles, this present conflict would not have eventuated. Bolshevism have been born. Without further announcement, may I present Father Coughlin.
Ladies and gentlemen and friends, it is idle for me to comment on the rapidly changing news. All the incidents of the past few days are insignificant and immaterial when compared to the catastrophic declaration of war. Before attempting to discuss a war which may become worldwide, let us pause to fix firmly the anchor of sound judgment upon the rock of right reason. We are Americans. For the most part, we trace our lineage to pioneers who came to this land seeking opportunities and security which were denied them abroad. As yet, we are a young nation from which English, Irish, Scotch, German, French, Italian, Polish, and all other European characteristics and attachments have not entirely disappeared. Naturally, then, we are subject to the sympathies which bind us to the old land. Naturally, we are not immune to the animosity which the ebb and flow of time's tide have created. As Americans, we are politically divided. Some of us are New Dealers. Some are Democrats. Some are Republicans, or Socialists, or Communists. As Americans, we are religiously divided. Some of us are Protestants. Some are Catholics. Some are Jews, and a great number of our fellow citizens profess no religious affiliation. As Americans, we are racially divided. Some of us are Jews, and the major part of our population is Gentile. Nevertheless, we are all American. Of this fact, we must become doubly conscious in this perilous hour. As difficult as it may be, it is necessary for us to subdue all feelings which we may entertain as a result of our ancestry and cultivate the spirit of American solidarity, a spirit which is wide enough to embrace every citizen of this country on an equal basis, independent of his origin. And as Americans, it is imperative at this moment to minimize our political differences and to emphasize our common trust in God. Let us recognize that all of us share in the heritage established more than a century and a half ago. a heritage born in the cradle of a revolution, which, viewed from a positive angle, attempted to and did establish a new nation with new ideas and a new philosophy of government. These ideals we must safeguard. Although we are prone to suffer from division, as I just pointed out, although therefore, consciously or unconsciously, we are concerned with the victory or defeat of the unfortunate European nations now engaged or about to be engaged in the forthcoming conflict, it is also imperative that as Americans of English, French, Polish, or any other descent, we must not entertain unkind, unjust thoughts, or practice unkind or unbecoming deeds against our fellow Americans whose ancestors originated in Germany or Italy or elsewhere. Together we must stand, appreciating and safeguarding our Americanism to such an extent that we will oppose every effort on the part of some misguided fellow citizens who attempt to create national hatred within our shores. Indeed, it is impossible for us to be disinterested in the war and in the afflictions about to be experienced by the unhappy nationals living abroad, while our interests toward them should be those of good Samaritans. Nevertheless, it appears sound to me that we should take every precaution lest in acting as good Samaritans, we become waylaid by the thieves of tyranny and destruction and be tapped into the ditch of hatred. Hatred of God and hatred of man. Therefore, love all men. Recognize that millions of foreign nationals have not had an opportunity to vote for or against war. Recognize that as a result of force and successful propaganda, they have been regimented into the trenches. Recognize that they have been victimized. Therefore, let us help all Europeans to terminate the war. And let us not be so foolish as to participate in it or to contribute towards its endurance. No foreign entanglements should be our policy. No participation in the dreadful war should be our objective. It is obvious that all nations and groups of nations will lose as a result of this war. All will suffer bankruptcy in finance and decay in war. Eventually, the combatants will convene to sign a second Treaty of Versailles, which, like every other European treaty that was independent of Christ, will be a mockery. Eventually, they will return to their capital to mobilize the citizens who escaped death for the rebuilding of highways, of homes, of public institutions, yes, and of more armament to safeguard an ephemeral peace. If the last world war, instead of saving democracy, was the forerunner of Russian and German dictatorship, this world war, if it comes to pass, they mark the passing not only of political freedom in Europe, but possibly the restriction of religious freedom. Why, therefore, should we Americans choose to walk upon the highway which leads from Jerusalem to Jericho to be beaten and robbed Is it not better for us to play the role of the Good Samaritan and be prepared to bind up the wounds of the victims of Antichrist, to help Europeans restore the political and religious liberty which for years have been assailed and which probably will be assailed again. I not only plead with you, my friends, to avoid all animosities at home, animosities which might originate between German and French, Polish and Italian, Irish and English. I not only plead with you to avoid all foreign entanglements which cannot at the present moment accomplish any definite good. I not only plead that in your conversations you will not be responsible for stirring up any ill feeling against any citizens of our country, but I plead with you to make a distinction between the foreign peoples and their governments. Entertain no unchristian thought towards the French people. Utter no reproach against the Polish people, the Russian people, the German people. Think kindly of the English people and the Italian people. Oh, have we not long since learned that all people are good people? Have we not long since known that the poor people of every nation are God's people who have been flogged in a pilot dungeon by the scourge of war? Who have been crowned with the same thorns of poverty which many of you Americans wear upon your brow, and who have been crucified between the two themes of hate and greed. Be reasonable, therefore, in distinguishing peoples from their government. Particularly God's people from certain godless governments. My friends, do not become thoughtless victims of emotion. Do not become pawns of invisible forces which for their own subversive ends will attempt to persuade you to join in a hymn of hate. Love your neighbor, whoever he is, and wherever he is. And let not the artificial barriers of nature or the accidents of race place limitations upon the charity which we must entertain for all of God's children. If it were so, that our entrance as a military force into the world conflict would accomplish something noble, something worthwhile, I should be among the first to persuade you to take up arms. But should we enter now on the side of Poland and England and France, we would become party to sustaining the immorality of the peace treaty of Versailles, and parties in an effort to perpetuate the immoralities of international finance. If we should enter the forthcoming conflict on the side of Germany and her allies, we would share the responsibility of prolonging the rebellion against God and against man. But who knows what the future holds for us? Possibly that future may determine that we contribute our all in battling for Christ against Antichrist. Meanwhile, however, when truth and justice are in the process of being clarified, Let it be remembered that our American government definitely refused to ratify the peace treaty of Versailles because its signatories rejected not only the 14 points proposed by President Wilson, but repudiated the sound principles of Americanism. Let it be remembered that we may not enter this conflict on the side of Germany, lest we be guilty of cooperating with both brown and red Bolsheviks. Let it be remembered that the physical, the financial, and the moral losses we sustain from the world war may be forerunners of what we may anticipate following the next war, unless it becomes a war not for commercial gain, but for the preservation of Christ's principles and for liberty. But in this war as it now exists, a war that is traced back to 1,000 injustices originating among all the contestants, we must not enter until it becomes clear as the noonday sun that one side or the other repents of the causes which threaten to weaken civilization, leaving it an easy target for the victorious assault of Antichrist. Oh, I am aware, and so are you, that at this moment, Paris and London are being evacuated. Visualize the highways leading from London, filled with buses which carry the precious cargo of little children and expectant mothers. Waterloo Station is crammed with schoolboys and schoolgirls who are being funneled into day courses. And their destination? Their destination is rural England, where thousands of these innocents will live sheltered in tents, where they will be fed at a common commissariat, where they will be subjected to disease, and where they will be initiated in the rudiments of totalitarianism as they become innocent wards of the state. Yes, that is modern war. In former wars, husbands and older sons marched to the French. In former wars, which were more or less confined to one area and between two nations, the entire world was not vitally affected. But in modern times, children and mothers and wives and the aged and informed are among the first casualties. Oh, our task is to hold fast to peace. Our task is to hold fast to the American attitude towards the peace treaty of Versailles. Our task is to hold fast to our constant attitude towards red and brown Bolshevism, which was catapulted upon us as a result of that unjust peace treaty. Oh, have the world in 1917 listened to Pope Benedict XV before the signing of that immoral peace treaty of Versailles? This war, in this year, would not have resulted. Our task, therefore, is to retain American neutrality. Mothers and fathers of America, what would be your reaction were your little boys and girls herded to some concentration camp? What would be your thoughts as you lay your heads upon a sleepless pillow
and listen to the drone of farmers above. Farmers freighted with sudden death. Or perhaps these nightmarish thoughts may be less disturbing than the thoughts of having your darlings exposed to the cruelties of camp life, to the methodic officialdom of strangers, and to the indifference in matters of religion, which will be obligatory in the name of tolerance. Farmers spare neither children nor mothers, neither the aged nor the infirm, and lethal gas recognizes no law of love, but obeys the winds and currents, even though the rows of white tents in their paths house millions of babies and mothers. And the concentration of thousands of children are likewise subject to the lethal gas of religious indifference. Yes, Germany, Poland, England, and France are at war. But the majority of Englishmen and Frenchmen, of men and women of every European nationality, do not want war any more than we want war. They want the peace and contentment of their home. They want their children sheltered under their own roof. They want prosperity. They want to till their overtaxed farms, to work in their idle factories, to produce food and clothing and the conveniences of life. They want the benedictions of Christianity and not the maledictions of paganism. And they want something of America. They want America to heed their inarticulate cries rather than the pronouncements of the power politicians, who are obviously interested in protecting either the half of gold and the ghastly gains of imperial profiteers, or else in establishing the kingdom of Satan. Could we penetrate the veil of secrecy which enshrouds Germany and Russia? Could we hearken to the stifled cries which escape from the lips of Bavarian, Bohemian, Prussian, Czechoslovakian, Ukrainian, Georgian, and the inhabitants of Black Siberia? Our ears would become attuned to a supplication which, in the words of Job, would say, "Have pity on me, at least you, my friend, for the hand of the Lord has touched me. Have pity on me, lest I in godless Moscow must abandon hope for freedom, lest I, an automaton in the militarized Berlin, must remain forever a spinning cog in the speeding wheel of a state god." And the Englishman and Frenchman would say, "Have pity on me, as I work only to eke out a miserable existence in the shipyards on the Tyne, in the coal fields of Wales, on the waterfront of Liverpool and Marseille, or in the slums of London and Paris. I, who have suffered and sorrowed, dreaming of a happier day, have pity on me, lest I too be used as cannon fodder to sustain the injustices of the past, and finally condemned to wear a red or brown shirt until liberated by death. Oh, America," cry all Europeans, "oh, America, in this hour of need, stand firm against the machinations of the warmongers. Speak to them not one word of encouragement. Remind them that we, the poor people of Europe, never once prospered as a result of their commercialized bloodshed. Now that the skies are filled with lethal engines of destruction, Now that our fathers and sons are preparing to lay down their lives and... Now that the future is darkened with black clouds, speak out bravely, America. Speak out bravely in criticism of our unchristian leaders and their unchristian policies. We dare not. But you dare recall the broken promises of the London Peace Treaty, of the Disarmament Pact, of the litany of broken agreements to which our leaders were party in the past. All do these things for us, fellow Americans, and the foul politicians who dominate us and whose puppet propagandize you with their version of the story, they will never venture upon a world war. That, my friend, is what I think that the common people of England and Europe are speaking to us. That is the message that the common people of Europe are sending to us on the invisible airways of God's love. Meanwhile, I know the reaction which the crisis abroad is creating in our own stock market. The prices of all commodities have risen. Steel and industries are soaring to new highs for this year. Soon the factory chimneys will belch their black smoke. Soon the problem of unemployment will be solved in America. Soon our harbors will be choked with raw material ready for export. Soon the old economic mechanism which concentrates wealth in the hands of a few will be oiled with the private credit of those who dictate to government. And soon, if our American power politicians have their way, my fellow citizens, you will return from work to your mortgage home some evening, conscious that during your working hours, you have helped to build cannon and howitzer and shrapnel, which will deal out death and destruction to another 10 million innocent victims whose masters refuse to attend to the words of Christ and his vicar. Peace on earth to men of good will. And then when the last shot will have been fired, then when the last horse will have been buried, then you and I, fellow Americans, will recreate ourselves at some motion picture theater to view the ruins of what once was London, Paris, Berlin, and Warsaw. Then we will attune our ears to some radio program which will announce to us the overthrow of Hitler, the Bolshevization of France, and possibly the socialization of England, and the ascendancy of godless Russia. A new treaty will be signed, and a new pact hypocritically will be avowed. Survivors of the conflicts already returned to their desolated country, yes, 10 million or more of them, we'll seek employment where there is no employment. New governments will set about to find means to repay the bondholders who were careful during the days of Armageddon to hide themselves and feed themselves in cases. And because there is no employment for the 10 million veterans, because the wealth of every land has been dissipated, because there is no private wealth left to tax the new government, because factories have been closed, because Palmer's husband stopped, then the government, under some such teacher's name as the Army of Reconstruction, will arrange for the regimentation of the workers of Europe, as Stalin regimented them, as Hitler regimented them, as every dictator necessarily regiments them, to walk and slave upon the Reconstruction Project at less than living wages. Not for the benefit of government, not for the benefit of the melancholy population, but for the benefit of those and only those who in the past as in the future profiteer upon the merchandise of flesh and blood. And the world, yes, the world will celebrate the signing of such a peace with you.
What does the future hold for us in America if we engage in this blood business abroad? Need I rehearse for you the story of the last war's aftermath? Need I recall for you how the false prosperity predicated upon destruction began to vanish like mist in the noonday sun following 1920? Have you forgotten what happened not only to the Kellogg Peace Pact, to the Dawes plan for European reconstruction? Are you inexperienced in the tragedy of unemployment resulting from the closing of our munition factories? Are you blind to the growth of the radicalism which followed? And are you unmindful of the confiscation of farms and homes and unbearable taxation which you suffered? All wars never produce prosperity. Wars always, with few exceptions, were the cradles of destruction and radicalism. Indeed, it is chiefly the men of the laboring class and the agricultural class who fight the wars, who die in the wars, and who pay for the wars. Oh, but it becomes more evident year by year that no class, the professional class, the financial class, and the industrial class, can escape the inevitable toll. Is it not evident, Mr. Industrialist and Financialist, that when the laboring and agricultural classes are overtaxed and unemployed, that you manufacturers dare not produce? Is it not evident when economic stagnation eventuates that the bankers have no one to whom they can lend money save the government? Does not our experience teach us that when governments borrow billions upon billions of dollars of privately created money, that there arises the necessity of pyramiding more taxes upon the backs of the unemployed and the poor? And from it all, does there not arise class hatred led by rabid radicals? Class hatred that during the past several years threatened the foundations of this republic. Oh, yes. Mr. Industrialist and Financialist. Following the next world war, and this is certain if America enters. Following the next world war, should we enter into it and thereby invite all the repercussions which follow from it, is it outside the realm of possibility that this same class hatred and these same excesses will destroy both rich and poor alike? Well, then, may we encourage the League Against War. But encouraging it, let us be positive to encourage a league for war's antidote. And that league is the League for Christianity. It is the League for peace. It is the League for brotherly love. It is the League to sustain the principles of Calvary's victory. It is the only league whose foundations can be erected and upon which can be built the structure of lasting prosperity. Appropriate is the following excerpt from the Gospel of Christ, which I submit for your consideration. It is taken from the Gospel of Christ according to St. Matthew, chapter the 6th, and reads as follows. At that time, Jesus said to his disciples, "No man can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will sustain the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Therefore I say to you, be not solicitous for your life, what you shall eat, nor for your body, what you shall put on. Is not the life more than the meat, and the body more than the raiment? Behold the birds of the air, for they neither sow, nor do they reap, nor gather into barns, and your heavenly Father feedeth them. Are not you of much more value than they? And which of you by taking thought can add to his stature one cubit? And for raiment, why are you so little? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They labor not, neither do they spin. But I say to you that not even Solomon in all his glory was arrayed as one of these. Now if God so clothed the grass of the field, which is today and tomorrow is cast into the oven, how much more you, O ye of little faith? Be not solicitous, therefore, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or wherewith shall we be clothed? For after all these things do the heathens. For your Father knoweth that you have need of all these things. Seek ye therefore first the kingdom of God and his justice, and all these things shall be added unto you." Thus spoke Jesus Christ. In this day of turmoil, on this occasion when millions of men are being mobilized, when cities are being emptied of their women and children, in this day when we Americans are nursing prejudices against the Germans, or the Russians, or the Italians, or the Polish, or the French, or the English, in this day when stock markets are rising at home, and when thoughtless men secretly entertain hopes for profit in the market, and for employment in munition factories as a result of war, and in this day when certain political leaders desire war, leaders who were unable through their policies to solve the question of peacetime idleness. It is most pertinent to analyze the content of the gospel excerpt, which I'll read for you. No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will sustain the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and man. To understand the real emphasis which Christ placed upon these words, it is necessary to recall that he said, "He who is not with me is against me." It is necessary to appreciate that the Prince of Peace permits no compromise. For most certainly, if we are not with him, we cannot be neutral. We are against him. If we do not sustain the Prince of Peace completely, then consciously or unconsciously, we become servants of Mammon, minions of Mars, and little sir echoes of the warmongers themselves, of Hitler and of Stalin. Even though we berate them and parade against them, even though we protest against them. Oh, yes, we are solicitors for our life. We who dread suffering, we who blanch at the mere thought of war with its broken body. Yet, why should we be solicitors for bread, for a home, for the necessities of life any more than the birds of the air appear to be solicitors for the nest they build, the limpid streams from which they drink, or the fields from which they garner their food? Why are not they solicitors? Because, my friends, they obey the law that God has ordained for them. Because they are faithful to the instincts which God has implanted within them. And because they are content to dwell within their own element. Alas, man is always solicitous when his next crust of bread will come. Always he's perturbed over the security of his home. Always he's the pawn of the warmongers. And why? Yes, because he is not faithful to the law of Jesus Christ, the Prince of Peace. Because governments have removed the master and his counsels from their parliaments and executive chambers. Because industrialists and financialists have excluded him from the temple. And finally, because man, the creature, and the personal property of Jesus Christ has endeavored to live on an element outside the element and confines of Christianity, he who is not with me is against me. Is there no hope for poor humanity? Certainly there is, my friend. And it is found only in the peace of Jesus Christ. Were we and our governments faithful to him who redeemed us, to him who established for us a sound social system, there would be no need for our being solicitors for our life, for the things we eat, for the things we wear. No need to be solicitors over peace or war. For if Christianity were operative and practiced by the nations of the world, automatically it would produce such prosperity and guarantee such peace that the materialities for which we exhibit so much concern would become as commonplace as the air we breathe and the sunshine we enjoy. No wonder Christ instructed us that only heathens struggle and fight and die like rats in a trench for the necessities of this life, which are always within their grasp, but never within their possession. And the explanation is that the heathens are victimized by an unsound, impractical social order, foreign to the social order instituted by Jesus Christ. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his justice, and all these things shall be added unto you. Bread, peace, and prosperity. My friends, in this critical hour, I plead with you not to shirk your duty. Be valiant for the cause of social justice. And by social justice, I mean nothing more or less than Christ's social order. A social order promulgated by one who proved his divinity, by one who departed from our midst after having prayed that we be one. In conclusion, may I quote from the Congressional Record the stirring words of Mr. Schaefer, who said, "From millions of lips in America, the word war falls. In thousands of newspaper columns, the word war appears. Over the airwaves, night and day, the word war vibrates. Of what do we speak when we utter the word war? Blaring bands, martial airs, gaudy uniforms, ringing cheers, the rhythm of marching feet, the glint of sunlight on shining bayonets and polished guns, the skies darkened by flocks of airplanes, the air drumming and vibrant with the drone of mortars, panoply, parade. Oh, but back of all that, what? The unutterable ache, the unplumbed agony of human hearts and human souls, as fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters, wives, sweethearts, and children bid farewell to the loved ones as they go marching away, perhaps never to return. Long months, aye, years of that hopeless agony of waiting for some word as to whether those loved ones still live. In the fields of Europe, the mud and water, the vermin, the stench of the trench. Men, unkempt, unshaven, cold men, literally drunk from the loss of sleep. Hopeless, horror-ridden men. Men waiting in the darkness before the dawn of the zero hour to go over the top. And sleek, audacious rats. Trench rats, fattened on the flesh of the fallen, scurrying along the trench ways, brushing the feet of men whom they will soon devour. The greenish light of the rockets, the hellish thunder and roar of cannon, the rattle of machine guns. Across a sea of mud churned into muck by the feet of fighting men, mixed with the mangled bits of flesh of those who were the beloved of American fathers and mothers and brothers and sisters. Men whose bodies are blasted into mincemeat to be churned up in the blood of no man's land. And out yonder as the gay dawn brings the hour for a new struggle, torn bodies hanging limp and grotesque, bloody and mangled on the barbed wire entrenchments, the bodies of American sons. And over all that awful mist of the early morning rising from that corner, a stench, a miasma of death comes in the nostrils of the living. That, my friends, is what we talk about when we pronounce that awful word, war. When we listen to the propaganda of keeping the world safe for democracy. Yes, for international capitalism, for Bolshevism, for Nazism, and for those only who profiteer upon death. But more horrible than all these physical and social sufferings, war means the end of liberty and possible end of Christian morality in many nations. More than 20 years ago, we Americans participated in a war to end war. No 20 years in all history has seen more wars than those which have elapsed since the signing of the Versailles Peace Treaty. Clemenceau, one of the chief signatories of that iniquitous document, cynically sneered that his pet treaty would breed 11 wars. And time has proven that his observation was correct. Ladies and gentlemen, there is only one war in which we must engage. Some of you will call it the war to end unemployment, to reestablish prosperity and peace. Some of you will call it a war to preserve Americanism in its pristine purity. But for the more analytical ones amongst you, it will be called a war for Christ and Christ's principles. That's the only war by which all wars can be ended. That's the only war that will multiply private property. That's the only war which will rid the face of the earth of protected rocketeers, of warmongers, of haters of mankind, and the followers of Antichrist. That's the only war which begins by regimenting our personal resources to fight the battle against immorality within our own souls. That's the only war whose captain is Christ, whose sword is justice, whose helmet is the gospel of salvation, and whose defense weapon is the policy of love. And those are the only weapons which the good Samaritan dare export to Europe. Christ's weapons for the reconstruction of the world. Paradoxically, this day of war is the eve of Labor Day. Many Americans celebrate this national holiday with a degree of cynicism. For there is little profitable labor left for American men. Many others celebrate it with glee, because they have won recognition for their labor use. That's a good and just reason. Many others, unfortunately, not gifted with the analysis of history, not understanding the gospel of Jesus Christ, but filled with the knowledge of Russian Stalinism, filled with the esprit of German Hitlerism, these are looking forward to the establishment of some kind of proletarian form of government throughout the world and in this nation. Gentlemen of the laboring class, I beg of you to learn that without Christ, nothing lasting is accomplished. You know history. What of the former wars won for you? Only the privilege of dying in the trenches. Only the privilege of returning jobless to your homes. Only the privilege of bearing the bonds of death. Only the privilege of becoming radicalized in this land of liberty. Yes, without Christ, nothing good is accomplished by any man. After all, men are men. Men remain men when they rise to power, be it the power of the politician or the power of the labor leader. Men without God and without his son's social order burning in their hearts will go the way of all men, and their most sincere hopes will meet the fate of the hopes which originally burned within the heart of the Russian revolutionist or the German National Socialist. Oh, if Labor Day, which paradoxically is the birthday of another war, and perhaps the death day of European civilization, if this Labor Day means anything to you, I appeal to you to make it a Labor Day that's in harmony with the mind of the carpenter of Nazareth. For without him, said he, we can do nothing. And with him, yes, we can live and enjoy the bountiful goodness which he has scattered over the face of America. Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. And anyone who is not with Christ and of Christ and in Christ, his opponent, his antichrist, that other one, yes, he is the way and the lie and the death. Therefore I ask you, fellow citizens, wherever you may be, in your home, in your clubs, or even in your public gatherings, I ask you at this moment to stand with me and with bowed, reverent heads, recite the Lord's Prayer to the end, that peace will descend upon Europe, that America will retain her neutrality, and that we will export abroad the arms of Christ's principles. I ask that you will pray that these known and unknown warmongers will be finally vanquished, and that Christ's kingdom, together with the flag of his empire, his cross, will descend upon this troubled earth. My friends, please stand up with me. Yes, stand. And let our prayer be heard around the world. I shall recite the first part. Join with me throughout America in the last part. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. God bless you, fellow Americans. If you write to me this week, I shall be glad to mail you a copy of the address I've just given.
And now, in the remaining moments of our broadcast, the Little Flower Choristers sing for us, O Sacred Heart, O Love Divine.
Oh.
as late as last April, Father Coughlin predicted that Red Russia and Brown Germany would amalgamate their forces. This has been accomplished. But as yet, the thoroughgoing opposition which should be established against this joint menace is insufficient. Numbers mean nothing. All the nations in the world on the opposing side amount to nothing. What counts and what alone counts is Christianity. Without Christianity, as the peace treaty of Versailles proved, no victory can be achieved, and no lasting peace can be achieved. A peace treaty without Christ's spirit breeds another war more terrible than the one which preceded the treaty. Let us therefore try to eradicate the causes of the last war. The immoralities of the peace treaty of Versailles and the incorporation of the principles of Christianity in all the nations of the world. That was the program of Benedict XV in 1917. That must be our program today. Write today to Father Coughlin and ask him to send you a copy of the address to which you listened and to arrange that you will receive a regular copy of Social Justice. Sunday afternoon at this same time, when once again Father Coughlin will be with you, this is your announcer, Franklin Mitchell, bidding you good day.
We have presented the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan. Statements made and views expressed on this program are made on the sole responsibility of the sponsor and do not reflect the views of this station, its management, or its personnel. Father Coughlin's address came to you as a presentation on your dial at 1250 kilocycles. WHBI, Hoyt Brothers Incorporated.